Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're calling on three witnesses this hour, witnesses to the summer of discontent in the American thinking class. The crabby mood infests faculty clubs, editorial boardrooms, mastheads of the magazines, where the contours of an American consensus get hammered out for general consumption. President Trump is part of this picture at Mount Rushmore last weekend, yelling in effect, "You're fired," to the intelligentsia at large. He was decrying a cancel culture of totalitarian political correctness, he said, a left-wing cultural revolution that's trying to overthrow American liberty. But he is not on our guest list. Noam Chomsky is the modern model of radical dissent. Also, Tressy McMillan Cottom, a hawk-eyed observer of thinking class behavior. She says old-fashioned racism is a bigger damper on our democracy than the new cancel culture. We begin with the Sterling Professor of English at Yale, David Bromwich, who writes widely about the political scene from left libertarian convictions. He signed the Harper's Magazine letter, as Noam Chomsky did too, voicing concern about an illiberal trend in elite culture. But Bromwich's reasoning was his own.
I thought it stated very plainly what the nature of the problems is with culture of intellectual, political, and moral bigotry we're seeing in the academic, journalistic, entertainment world. There were earlier signs of it in some aspects of the Me Too shaming and shunning, but it's gone to a higher level, more intense, and gone on longer on the impetus of terrible events, such as the killing of George Floyd, in the last many weeks. And I think it's drawn also on the bewilderment, the fright, the anxiety many people feel over COVID. It has many sources, but the manifestation is this culture, to call it a culture of scandal and finding out things about people that they said in the past, often the very distant past.
What do you call this phenomenon?
It has some traits in common with the cultural Stalinism of the Communist Party in the 1930s, wow. But it is a Stalinism without Stalin. It has no political power behind it. It is a power in the world of culture, and it has some traits in common with McCarthyism, but it's a peculiar kind of blacklist. It's much more damaging immediately than the imputation of past communist connections was. You could lose your job all at once. But on the other hand, the people who make the charges don't altogether seem to believe their own ideology, because a groveling and abject apology is all it takes very often to assure that you'll get a job further on somewhere along the way. It is a phenomenon of the mass mind. It's a crowd manifestation. And I think the crowd has become a different sort of creature because of social media.
The Harper's letter spoke of a threat to enlightened discourse, free, open political conversation.
Yes.
But it also saw a threat to democracy. I mean, is that a little far?
Well, if you don't recognize the all importance of free, open debate, that is to say, the attempted use of persuasion rather than force as a way of arriving at political judgments, political decisions, and also the determination not to turn everything into politics. Unless you believe in that democratic existence, the coexistence of many citizens of different kinds becomes impossible. Mm. Pretty much all the signers are people who see, as the letter spoke of, a great danger of this very kind emanating from the present White House, from the demagogue leader of this country, Donald Trump. But if that also becomes the base note of the preponderance of other forces, let's call it the left liberal corporate culture as represented by institutions such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Yorker, the networks, CNN, the entertainment business, etc., and many journalism schools now, if we see all of them speaking as with one voice and having headlines that are so editorializing as to say, for example, one in the Times did the other day, Swamp supports Trump. That is the New York Times doing the New York Post. If everything turns in that direction, then people forget how to listen. And again, I trace some of this change of habits to social media, where people retweet short articles in even shorter tweet capsules, and often claim afterwards not even to have read the articles they tweet, but to be implicitly approving of them when they spread them around. Again, something that Donald Trump does as the chief offender, the world's international number one star of Twitter.
David, so many things going on, as you say, including a pandemic, social media, Twitter, Donald Trump in re-election campaign mode, but also a generational divide here, maybe in an evolving commentariat. Make what you will of the strangest piece of it, that Donald Trump from Mount Rushmore is sounding some of the same themes, that there's a wave of intolerance coming. It's driven by the left wing. Right. It's totalitarian in its tendency. How did your letter signers and Donald Trump fall into some vague, I won't say alignment, but you're rhyming, or he's rhyming with you?
There were some good sentences in that talk by Trump, but of course his denunciation of the totalitarian left and of their desire to take down all our monuments and the assertion that they hated America, these were very much political plays by a seasoned politician and, as I said, demagogue. And he was using the word totalitarian, probably a fairly new word to him, in the ordinary sense of the word. But it's also the case that he was seeing the most, hackneyed, cliched, accepted names and phrases and understandings that one has grown up with in American politics and society in the last 60 or 70 years, suddenly not only questioned, but in some cases literally torn down, exposed to ridicule and humiliation. And I'm sure he was surprised by that. Many people were. It's less shocking to me because the worship of statues just seems to me a worship of icons, idolatry. But I think for that very reason, the fascination with destroying these things is also peculiar. Mm. Not enough has been said about that. A great many on the left who either excuse or support or have participated in the hard push to rename institutions or buildings, or in the destruction or removal or trashing of monuments or statues, a lot of people who have supported that have said, well, this is often what governments do when they realize that their past is wrong or when they want to remake everything. And I would ask, which government can you name that did quite a lot of destruction of statues, old names, and old buildings that you admire? The Soviet Union, when they did that to Tsarist governments, the post-Soviet Union, when they did it to statues of Lenin, the act of caring so much about idolatrous images seems to be itself superstitious. And I mean superstition as the opposite of enlightenment.
What does the extreme politicization of culture tell you? I mean, we've had culture wars before, but people weren't losing jobs right and left.
There is such a thing as madness of the crowd. I'm afraid that on various fronts in American life over the last many years, we've seen groups of people impervious to conversation, discussion, debate with other groups.
I see two other things sort of below the surface in this story. One is the media technology. Twitter was made to make mobs.
Yep.
The other thing, though, is an insecurity about our economy. Journalism, as we've known it, is a dying industry, and people are incredibly insecure, people being laid off all over the place. The universities are incredibly insecure places. In other words, there's an atmosphere of acute personal tension.
You're describing a mood of panic. I don't know what else to call it. Maybe we've just been very lucky in America not to be seized by these moments of mass insanity. McCarthyism certainly was that, to judge by the oral history I had from the left-wing background in my family. If you ask me, and you may agree or not, Chris, the fever mood of war in the years 2002 to 2004 in the United States was such a mood of mass insanity, where you had people like Alan Dershowitz going on television, actually talking about the moral and legal justification for torture and why we should move the Constitution in that direction. These were extraordinary happenings. It started to calm down when we started to lose the Iraq War. But we're in another such moment now for a whole host of reasons you've described. Yes, economic, yes, actual racial awareness and conflict and tragedy. Nothing new about that, but it's suddenly flooding in on people. The figure of Donald Trump, the sense of the loss of American prestige and stature in the world. The dollar may no longer be the anchor currency 10 years from now. The feeling of no longer being a first-rate country. Europe is shutting us out. The United States is in the doghouse with Russia and Brazil. We are at the bottom of the world pile in dealing with the COVID epidemic. Right. So all of these feelings take on an arbitrary focus, and let's hunt down the people who have offended against race, who have offended against gender, who are not really of us, but seem to be part of our world. But if we can only purge them, if we can only interrogate ourselves, if we can only purify, things will get better. But my thought on that is purification only leads to more purification.
What were the signers of the Harper's Letter waiting for, do you suppose? And how do they assess the result of it?
The general recommitment, regrouping, rededication of foundations and cultural institutions to the, as it seems, almost exclusive study of race in a revisionist and radical spirit. And those pressures are anti-intellectual, and they're going to make universities much less free places than they were, let's say, from 1945 to 1995 or 2000 or so. The universities were the freest part of American life for all those years. The years, Chris, when you went to school, when I went to school, places like University of Chicago, Yale, UCLA, Michigan, they have become very far from the most free institutions in American life. And I would hate to see the divide between American politics and American education go the opposite direction, whereby politics, of all things, becomes a more open forum than university life. But that's possible. It's possible because of the sort of hard-edged unity of opinion that is being pushed right now.
Coming up, a counter-narrative of freedom and opportunity in the thinking class. This is Open Source. Tressie McMillan Cottom is an outspoken, widely traveled professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She practices her social science with a focus on higher education. She has written, for example, "The legacy of racism is not just carved into the facades of university buildings. It is found in the persistence of inherited privilege that shapes the composition of the curriculum, the student body, and the faculty." On most campuses these days, Tressie Cottom is feeling not constriction, but groundbreaking and expansion.
I see the greatest period in democratic knowledge production in the history of the West. More people have more opportunities to speak to their own experiences in a variety of ways than has ever been possible before in recorded history. I see institutions that have struggled against the prestige of the Harvard, Yale, Brown, Princetons of the world, finding ways for their students and their academic communities to take up some space in the public discourse. I don't think it is an accident that at the same time you have debates about constriction of public speech and public life, more people than ever before are participating in public life. So both of those things are true and they are related to each other. For someone at an elite social institution, the expansion of public life would feel like a contraction because their space in the public life has probably contracted. But a greater liberalism was always about increasing access, or so that's what we were told anyway. I think what we have here is a debate about terms and about people's relative power position in public life. I think people thought that they could expand public life the denominator, the number of ideas and the number of people, while controlling the numerator, meaning the number of people who actually get heard and accrue privileges based on it. I don't see this illiberalism out in the world. To the extent that I see a cancel culture, by the way, it is driven by the corporatization of public life and not by individuals who are pushing back against the narratives about who they are or what they should believe. If there's a cancel culture, it's happening because Google owns everything on your college campus or because Facebook, right? That's cancel culture. Cancel culture is when we are so captured by digital platforms and corporate monopolies that even though we can speak freely, we cannot control the terms of that speech. That's cancel culture. What people are experiencing when someone writes, albeit a very uncomfortable or undesirable letter to their boss, or they experience some material consequences for their speech acts, that may be a type of problem, but it is not cancellation.
Tracy, I've been waiting to hear this view from, shall we say, the rising gen or the new players, that they're thriving. This is a huge opportunity. Where does this feeling come from that there's something suffocating out there, something less free than we used to enjoy? David Bromwich was saying universities used to be the freest places in our world, and they're not that anymore.
Let's see. My grandmother wasn't allowed to go to college because she was a Black woman. Colleges that used to be free were free because of who was not allowed to participate in them. There is no golden era of higher education for some of us. And I am one of those people. I am not possible 40 years prior to when I become an academic. Quite literally, I am not possible. My family is not only Black and Southern, we are rural and Southern. We come from a history of sharecropping. We come from a poor part of the state of North Carolina. The idea of the higher education that someone like David probably remembers is not the same golden era of free higher education, free spirit and free speech of higher education that I would recall or that the people who made me would recall. I do think it is true that institutions had more latitude to determine the debates that were had and who was allowed to participate, that for the people who cleared that significant bar, those institutions did feel quite free. But that was because they agreed on some basic assumptions that they never really questioned, which was that those people in those institutions belong there, that they should be the ones driving public debate, that they should be the ones driving discourse. When that fundamental assumption, however, was called into question by more women, by more people of color, by more working class people participating in higher education, I do think that called into question whether or not everybody was free to speak as they wanted, because they could no longer appeal to the shared belief that everybody who was there belonged there. So I think the material conditions of higher education, we really do have to keep in mind, and that when people are calling out to this romantic past, it is a very limited, narrow historicization of the past that is not true for everybody.
Speak of the tech, specifically Twitter, which has changed the conversation and I think invites mobs. But what sort of arena do you find social media for a social justice movement and consciousness?
Social media, as we now know it, which is, let's be clear, just because we can all freely participate in social media does not mean that it is a democratic space. True. So Twitter and Facebook, for example, are actually not the public square. It is just that this is what the public square has been reduced to. There are a new set of terms that have been introduced about how discourse will happen because platforms have incentives. They are there to make money off of our engagement and our attention. And the platforms are designed to drive aggressive interaction because those are the types of things that drive people to participate in the platform. We become valuable to Twitter when we are angry. It really is that simple.
Interesting.
It is our attention that is being resold to advertisers. It is not the public square that we are seeing in Twitter. Pew data shows that fewer than a quarter of the American population are engaged in Twitter, even casually. This is not a huge swath of America, right? It is a highly self-selected group of people who want to have a certain type of discourse. The problem that makes for a lot of academics, and I think especially public intellectuals, is that we want to be in that space. It is a space designed for us. It's well text-based, it's discourse-based, but the terms of the space are just a bit too democratic for them to dominate the space the way they probably prefer.
Tracy, you've said that public engagement is a different and riskier game for Black intellectuals. What do
That's
you mean?
Right. You know, I find it almost charming that we are talking about cancel culture for overwhelmingly economically secure people in the profession. Because cancel culture has always existed for certain types of intellectuals. Anything considered, you know, minoritized, whether that be race, gender, class, or sexuality, especially the intersections of those. Scholars who live in those spaces have always felt like their speech was being policed by institutions and by their professional cohort members, because they have been. At the same time that we are shaking our fists at the sky at cancel culture, students in the year 2020 at an institution like Berkeley, they are agitating for an African-American studies department or ethnic studies department. Those types of speech around certain areas of discourse related to ethnicity or race or sexuality or gender have always been policed. The people who participate in them have always paid a professional price for their speech acts related to that work. We have been the last hired. We are least likely to be tenured or retained. We are the least likely to move into positions of leadership in universities. And we are the ones most expected to go out and fight the good fight in the public sphere on behalf of all of the silenced minorities. We are the ones called on when the institution is called onto the carpet for their diversity problem. We're the ones whose students pull at us to please be on Twitter or Facebook to make a difference and to help model for them a future in academia. That increases our risks significantly at the same time that we are vulnerable in these institutions that benefit significantly when we do this work. If there are people who have been canceled, it's those people.
Is it possible that race could ever capture too much of the conversation? Race in Shakespeare, race in organic chemistry, race across the campus.
I mean, I think it's possible. I don't think we're anywhere near that now. I think it can feel that way. Again, when I'm being my most fair to people who believe differently than I do on these issues, I suspect this does feel like a reckoning, right? It must be that you woke up one day and it feels like everyone was having a conversation to which you had not been invited. What I think it is difficult for those people to understand is that that's always been true for everyone else. And that remains true for everyone else. Listen, when you're doing something like race in Shakespeare, by the way, and I know many people in that field, which is why I use that example and love that you brought it up, because it's a fascinating subfield.
Right.
When they're doing race in Shakespeare, they are also doing Shakespeare. Everybody that I know who does the quote unquote race work is also expert in the dominant parts of their discipline. They just do that in addition to becoming expert in how that field intersects with race. Mm. The disciplines have not lost participants in the conversation, which is why it feels very strange to me that people would see something like race and Shakespeare as being a departure from the study of Shakespeare. It's odd to me that people would find that as a challenge to their domain of expertise. I think the best way to look at this is that there is a competition for status and exposure and recognition. And when race seems like the it topic, there is a sense that some people have an unfair advantage professionally in speaking about a subject that you would really rather not become fluent in. I think that, you know, there's a bit of professional jockeying happening here that then gets wrapped up in the more high-minded philosophical language of liberalism and illiberalism.
Tracy, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm hearing, in summary, a kind of exultation in this technologically opened up mode of higher education.
Mm-hmm. That some people are able to participate and other people are not. Yes.
That more people, different kinds of people, even to capture the flag of conversation from time to time.
I can't get over the fact that what we're talking about here is probably still something like 20% of the public debate. Like, this is what we are contesting. I mean, our proportion of our outrage is just really out of step with what I think the actual reality of public discourse is. Now, listen, Chris, there are things absolutely that I think race doesn't entirely capture. I think where we have to be very precise about talking about social class, for example, when you talk about whistleblowers at Amazon being fired because they speak publicly about not having enough personal protection equipment, okay, this is a cancellation issue that a new digital public life has brought about. The fact that Amazon workers can speak directly to the public about their work conditions, and this creates for them undesirable consequences at work. That's cancellation. But that is an attention to power and class and privilege that is totally absent from the conversation that I think is happening at the highest echelons of this debate right now.
Who are the canceled that we ought to hear more about, and not necessarily intellectuals? I think of prisoners.
Yes.
Close to a million Black men imprisoned in this country. The ultimate cancellation.
Who are quite literally invisibilized.
Absolutely.
Both from the political and the public body. I think of the women who I have been speaking to a lot lately in my research, who work in service jobs, who have been agitating in their various ways for increasing the minimum wage, who have been speaking out about the sexual harassment they are facing at these jobs, the way that their access to even low-level hourly wage work has been conditioned by sexism and racism in the workplace, because they say on Facebook that their boss keeps touching them in the break room, all of a sudden their hours are cut, right? That to me is a problem of free speech. I think that we have a problem when our public educators, for example, are expected not to speak out on the area of expertise. They can't get on Facebook and talk about the state of education without jeopardizing their job as a public teacher. They're absolutely educators who have paid that price. They are also disproportionately women, I might add, and women of color who are usually sanctioned for doing so. I think about, as you said, the prisoners, and I especially think about those who are trapped in that bail system. I work a lot with bail funds to raise money. So this is before they are even convicted of a crime, even though it's a problem, I think, even after conviction. But even before conviction, the way that people are erased from life when they have a first contact with the quote-unquote criminal justice system because they cannot afford to pay their bail, that's actually cancellation, that you can lose your job even though you have not been convicted of a crime that is related to your employment simply because you cannot afford bail, right? That actually, to me, is about how we actually cancel people. Everyone that has been cited as examples in the current discourse around the letter who have experienced any consequences all experience temporary setbacks professionally, right? They have not experienced, however, the cycle of being involved in the justice system, for example, that cycle of court dates, of losing your job and then your apartment. That, to me, cancels you because cancellation is permanent. Cancellation is permanent. If we don't know anything else from the digital society, we should know the difference between being canceled and being unsubscribed, right? But that's not cancellation.
Tressie, there's something incredibly encouraging here, listening to you, in the sense that if there are that many people not in the conversation, jockeying, eager, almost desperate to get into it and to speak their piece, the society is not in such desperate trouble as I would have said.
No, far from it. It's easy to miss it depending on what your local news looks like. But everywhere in the country for the last 30 or 40 days, people have been out in the streets doing direct democratic action. People care for the first time in what feels like a really long time. People want to know what their budgets look like in their local municipalities, for goodness sake. People are reading the contracts that their police unions have with their local politicians. People are engaged and paying attention. That is a healthy public life. People who want to question democratic processes are doing democracy. People who just want democracy to happen on their own terms are doing fascism, even if they use the language of democracy. this is an exciting time, and it may be one of our last times to get it right. People care, still care about the discourse. We're in trouble when people stop caring.
What's your vision of life 10 years down the road?
You know, as a sociologist, I'm so often thinking backwards. We're not really trained to think forwards. But I'm also a Black woman, and if I didn't traffic in pragmatic hope, I just wouldn't make it, right? I have a lot of hope for the type of vision that a lot of the younger Black activists and intellectuals, especially the organic intellectuals, are talking about. They're talking about, in the very short near term, a future where we don't have bail. They're talking about a future where being incarcerated doesn't terminate your voting rights. I'm super excited about that. I'm excited about them envisioning not just universal health care, but universal health care that has mental health coverage, because we finally understand that being well is about more than just your blood pressure, right? They are articulating a very doable set, for the record, of social policies that would have made us certainly much more resilient in the face of a global health pandemic, right? We would have been so much better prepared for COVID. I'm really excited at how many of those people are running for local office. How many of them are not limiting, however, their imagination to just electoral politics and increasing like communities' capacity to respond to these really big problems. And I'm really excited for a future in the near term in 10 years where there are more Stacey Abrams of the world and less of what we have now. I really am excited for that. And I think that would look amazing.
Tressie McMillan Cottom, thank you for this conversation.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Chris.
Coming up, Noam Chomsky, canceled long before the cancel culture and still going strong. This is Open Source. I think of Noam Chomsky as the American Socrates, a relentless oppositionist and questioner in the public square from the start of the Vietnam War. The poison hemlock is always on offer for Professor Chomsky, but somehow he survives. At MIT from 1955, Chomsky was a pioneer in the science of language. He is unretired now at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He signed the Harper's Letter in support of open forums of ideas. It was an obvious, painless statement, he thought, about the lifeblood of liberal society. His big anxieties in 2020 run in other directions.
The Harper's Letter was a completely anodyne statement saying that it's a mistake to join the right wing by imposing things like banning talks, breaking up talks, setting up an environment in which people are free to say things and so on.
But why did you sign it? What was your concern in signing that letter?
It's a mistake for segments of the left to join in the right-wing establishment practice of silencing opinion you don't like.
I get it.
It's a very minor part of it, but it's wrong to do it. One of the consequences of this letter, which was interesting, was a stream of letters I'm getting from mostly young left academics describing to me their own experiences in having to walk on tiptoe on eggshells because of the toxic atmosphere that's been created. It's very small as compared with what the mainstream establishment does, but it shouldn't happen in principle. And it's a gift to the right, of course. They love it. In fact, Trump right now is building his whole campaign around it with totally wild claims, but enough people have had experiences so that there's some shreds of credibility assigned. And there should be no reaction because it's an obvious, simple point. The reaction shows that it's a much more serious issue than I thought. But it's a minor issue. I mean, there's lots of things we should be talking about, not an outbreak of irrationality in some segments of the intellectual classes.
Oh, well, let's talk about them. One of the books you and Ed Herman wrote, famous book, was called Manufacturing Consent, in which you argued basically that the big media has the job of building consensus around the social system, including capitalism, and war from time to time. Where do you see that job, that assignment, being carried out today in old media, in new media, in the general conversation?
If you look at the New York Times yesterday, there's a major article warning that of the danger that China might be violating U.S. sanctions by making a deal with Iran. And that's deeply concerning to us. Let's ask how an independent press would handle this question. The U.S. tore up a international agreement that was working very well with regard to Iranian nuclear weapons. The U.S. completely tore it up. The U.S. then imposed harsh sanctions on Iran, which have no status or validity whatsoever, except that the U.S. announced them. And now we're complaining about the fact that somebody is ignoring an outrageous demand that we made. It's fine. We have no right to block anyone else. We have no right to threaten Europe that we're going to toss them out of the international financial system if they go ahead with the agreement that they accepted and prefer. None of this has any justification whatsoever, but it's taken as the norm by the press. I should say that many people have misunderstood the book Manufacturing Consent. Many people have assumed that what we were saying is you can't trust the media. But we don't say that at all. We defended the media, the reporters, the correspondents. They do a great job. You can trust them. You've got to read them. First thing I do in the morning is read the New York Times, because that's the main source of news. But you have to read it with an understanding of the framework within which their choice of news is accepted and how it's framed. You have to compensate that, even though it's still the best source of news.
So much of the Times and big media in general has positioned itself at war with Donald Trump. He may feed on the criticism and the daily attacks, but how do you score that contest?
The Times and Trump?
Yeah.
Well, they despise him. They're very critical of him. Well, why shouldn't they be? This will sound outrageous, but it's an obvious truth. So let me make an outrageous, obviously true statement.
Please.
He is the most dangerous human being in history.
All right. Okay.
His climate policies are very clearly and explicitly directed to ending the prospects for human life on Earth in an organized human society in a very short term. Do I have to go through the details? You know the details. So the outrageous statement is true. Okay?
There's a lesson in your life, Noam Chomsky, of how to be influential even when you're blocked, even when you're dismissed.
I'm not complaining. I have plenty of avenues. The people who I'm speaking for are people who don't have a voice. This happens to people all over the place. The left, people on the left, it's a common experience. I happen to be lucky. I can use other avenues of expression. Most people can't.
Is there a lesson that others can apply there?
The lesson is to keep working to break down the culture of control and domination.
Noam, you've been at it a long time. How is this moment, 2020, different? You've spoken of the threat of Donald Trump himself against the environment, against survival. How else?
How else? This is the most unique moment in human history. We're at a moment of a confluence of four major catastrophes. One of them is the pandemic. There's three others. Go back to January. Every January, the famous doomsday clock is set with the minute hand a certain number of minutes to midnight, depending on an assessment of the global situation. Ever since Trump has been in office, the minute hand has been moved closer to midnight. 2 years ago, it reached the closest point to midnight it had ever reached. This last January, the analysts gave up on minutes. They turned to seconds. 100 seconds to midnight. They gave three reasons. One of them is the growing environmental catastrophe. Another one is the growing threat of nuclear war. The third crisis is the sharp deterioration of democracy. Why does that belong there? Because it's only through a vibrant, functioning democracy of an informed, engaged electorate that we can hope to deal with the first two crises. What's happened in the months since January? Donald Trump has made each of these crises much worse. That's a considerable achievement. He's made the pandemic worse. He's made the environmental crisis worse. He's made the nuclear threat much worse by continuing his project of dismantling the entire arms control regime. He's now even calling for breaking the comprehensive test ban treaty by carrying out nuclear tests. Can you tell me how this is being covered? No, what I'm called on by the media is to come and talk about a little trivial thing, the irrationality of intellectuals on an anodyne letter, but not these things.
People feel this danger in their bones. Noam Chomsky, what is a citizen to do? March, maybe.
We have all possibilities open to us. It's not a fascist state. You can do lots of things without danger. I mean, it's a real scandal that the nuclear issue is barely discussed. Okay, you can bring it up. It's been done before. In the early 1980s, there was a huge anti-nuclear movement. It's part of the background that led Reagan to agree with Gorbachev on the INF Treaty. It could be developed again. On the environmental issue, it's kind of a scandal, but our generation, yours and mine, are sitting back while young people are in the forefront of trying to do something about it. Mm. At the Davos meetings, they have to ask Greta Thunberg to make a statement. 16-year-old kid. Okay. How about us? What about the destruction of democracy? Now, the executive branch has been almost totally purified. There's nobody left in it except cowardly sycophants who repeat whatever Trump says. Congress had, the Republican Congress, incidentally, had imposed inspectors general to monitor executive offices. Now, they were starting to probe into the fetid swamp that Trump has created in Washington. So what did he do? Fired them all. Next, the federal attorney in the Southern District of New York, right, the most important one in the country, that's the Wall Street area, started to look into the same fetid swamp, Trump's massive corruption that he's introduced. So what did Trump do? Fired him, put in some flunky who's in favor of giving everything away to private equity corporations. That's what's happening to democracy before our eyes. Mm. We have a raging pandemic. Trump is making it much worse than any other country. Maybe Brazil is a competitor where they're run by a Trump clone trying to imitate him. It will end the pandemic somehow. We're not going to end the melting of the polar ice sheets. Another 4 years of Trump, we might reach irreversible tipping points. Now, we don't have a lot of time. These are the things that should be drilled into people's heads every minute.
Noam Chomsky, let me ask. I mean, since the murder of George Floyd by a policeman in Minneapolis, there has, in fact, been a real churning in the streets, in popular thinking and action. One piece of it is the toppling of statues, not just Confederate generals, but all sorts of people, including some of the founders who were slave owners, held to be objectionable for that reason. I mean, how do you feel watching this stuff?
This is the greatest popular movement in American history, Black Lives Matter and the protests in the street.
Okay.
Furthermore, it has enormous popular support. Polls are running like 2/3 support. That's way beyond what Martin Luther King had, even when he was popular.
Right.
He lost his popularity when he stopped just attacking racist Alabama sheriffs and started going to the North and condemning the Vietnam War, trying to organize a poor people's movement, black and white. At that point, he became harshly criticized by the liberal elite, and he ended up very unpopular. Okay, that was the wrong thing to do. But even at when he was popular, he didn't have the popularity of this movement. So it's a remarkable movement. It's going after important issues. It's even moving to the point of asking about the institutional bases of the tragedy of the Afro-American population, which has lived 400 years of first the most vicious slavery in human history, nothing like the slave regimes in the past. Then after 10 years of freedom, relative freedom, a revival of that system. This went on almost to the Second World War. Then comes a brief period of freedom, except that federal law, for example, prevented blacks from joining in home purchasing. It was into the late 60s. The federal regulations blocked blacks, so they lost out on that. Then goes on and on. There's a bitter, cruel legacy of 400 years. Now people are beginning to face it. It's a great thing. They're also beginning to face the genocidal assault on the native population. This is a tremendous increase in popular consciousness. Of course, the right wing hates it and vilifies it, but it's a very important development. Well, let's turn to the minor thing, the statues. You have to be careful about it. I think there's a big distinction between a statue of Robert E. Lee and a statue of Thomas Jefferson.
Interesting.
Furthermore, you have to ask yourself, what's the right way of dealing with the statues? Some of them, I think, really are so egregious that they should be just put away somewhere. But for some of them, you should use it as an educational opportunity.
Yes.
The statue of Thomas Jefferson should have on it his famous quote saying something like, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and his mercy will not last forever, meaning we will be punished for the hideous crimes of slavery. That should be put there so people know what was going on. They should know that the founders were almost entirely slave owners. A lot of them thought slavery was horrible, like Jefferson, but they accepted it. Maybe they hoped it would go away someday, but they accepted it. We should know these things.
We're getting to know these things as a matter of popular understanding and conversation as never before in my lifetime, Noam Chomsky. It is a very, very fascinating and exciting thing. I would hope that we can take it, we can learn it.
That's what the discussion should be about, not about some fashionable issue of an innocuous statement, which we should even talk about because it's so obvious. So yes, we should be talking about these things.
Lots more conversations ahead. Noam Chomsky, you've given us so many over the years and would love to do it again. Be well and thank you.
Okay, good to talk to you.
So that's what a chronic dissenter sounds like in his 92nd year of life. He's accessible, plain-spoken, happy to have a free mind and voice. He's never canceled anybody, and it turned out there was no way to cancel Noam Chomsky. Thanks again to Tressie McMillan-Cottom and David Bromwich. We had lots of help this week from Max Larkin, Maggie Doherty, Stephanie Burt, Maura Weigel, and Adam Fitzgerald. You can hear interviews that we couldn't fit into this hour with Matt Taibbi, P. Carl, and Kimani Gibson, all on our website at radioopensource.org. Please think of supporting Open Source. The best way is by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon. You'll get extras like Adam Coleman's ongoing series about reading in a time of social distance. This week, he's talking with Maggie Doherty about her new book called The Equivalence, all about Boston Cambridge's place on the historical map of poetry. Find it at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. We say farewell this week to a giant in audio engineering, our own meticulous and musical colleague and friend, George Hicks. Onward, George, ever onward. Mary McGrath is our culture warrior. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke.
Audio Collective.